Welcome to the Apple Context Machine, a podcast about all things Apple with your hosts, Jeff Gamet and Brian Chaffin.
Today is January 31st, 2011, and this is the Apple Context Machine, episode number 185, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, Bob Levitis' guitar boy. Get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you would like to comment on anything or question anything about the show or say anything you want to us, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
So, Brian, I just have to ask, since this is our first show since Macworld Expo wrapped up, how are you holding up?
Fine. And I made my title Bob Levitis' guitar boy because Bob had me help him out on his GarageBand 101 session at Macworld. And that's where he basically records, mixes, and masters and ships a song in under an hour with GarageBand. And really all I did was, you know, here's your tune guitar, Mr. Levitis, sir. Can I get you a cable, Mr. Levitis, sir?
So you were Bob's roadie.
I was his roadie, his guitar boy. I was actually calling myself his guitar bitch, but I thought that was, you know, a little bit incorrect.
No, I think it was totally spot on.
it's probably rewrite. Nonetheless, he had a good session. You know, he does that session so well. He's done it a lot. And what he does is he records a verse and a chorus of the Ramones' Rockaway Beach.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, and then, you know, then he has a version that he recorded for real, like, the, you know, from start to finish, where he actually, you know, everything's in tune and you know, all the harmonies are right and stuff, and then he actually plays that for everybody. But, you know, he just does a great job of showing how GarageBand actually works and just all the cool things that you can do with it without getting into so much detail that it takes too much time. And it's a really fun session. And if you go to Macworld next year, you should tune in and see it, or come in and see it. And it was a lot of fun. Now, you did a session.
Yes.
On cloud stuff.
And that's,
I'm
right,
assuming it was not talking about the greater ramifications of the Temptations' fantabulous song, Cloud Nine.
Dude, you're good. that was awesome. No, my session actually was not music related at all. So, yeah, I talked about different types of cloud services and cloud applications that you can use to make your life easier if you're working with, say, a desktop and a laptop Mac, and have an iPhone or iPod Touch and an iPad. So, yeah, so I showed off a bunch of really cool services like Dropbox, and talked about how, even though a lot of people aren't happy with MobileMe, why it can still be a valuable tool in your arsenal. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. And talked about services like Evernote and Instapaper and Simple Note, and showed people how I use all these tools to have all that important stuff that I need with me all the time.
And how did it go?
It went fantastic. I had a full house, which...
Fantastic.
Yes. And that's actually saying a lot, because the lineup, this was on Friday afternoon, the lineup for that time slot, I was doing a session. Ted Landau was doing a session. I think Bob had another one of his sessions going. And then the Macworld team had an editor's panel going as well. And I believe there was one other thing. It was all like big name, high power performances and me. And there was just so much going on that I figured there would be one session that was full and the rest of us would have maybe 15 people, but not so. Everyone had a full session. So that was awesome.
Well, the show is busy. We're going to get to that in a little bit. This is our Macworld wrap up show. So we're going to talk about some of the great products that we saw, and we're also going to talk about our impressions about the show overall. But I will interject there that you were one of the great powers that was speaking at that time. So I'm not surprised that you were full. Though I will humbly add that the other session that Bob and I did, where we were co-presenters, I wasn't just his guitar boy, was making music on the iPad, and I really expected that to be a popular track, and there weren't that many people that came for that one.
Maybe it was just a timing thing, because the whole idea of using your iPad as, say, a portable music studio, I think is just so cool.
It is, and you know, with the popularity of golly, and I can't remember the name of it, that mega church that put the band on stage doing Christmas carols with iPads.
See, that was a perfect example of just how versatile the iPad can be as an instrument.
Yeah, but between that and Damon from the Gorillaz recording and releasing an album entirely on the iPad. Actually, I'm sure it was it was released through a computer, but whatever. Anyway, recording and mixing and mastering an album entirely on the iPad. You know, I think that the iPad is going to be an important musical device in the future, but we may have been a bit fast on the gun for doing a session on that. But nonetheless, the people that were there enjoyed it, and we had a good time talking about all the stuff that was going on. In the meanwhile, I guess I'll just segue with the fact that we both sound the worst for wear and tear.
Yes. You know, usually when I come back to the TMO Central Towers from mm-hmm. Macworld, my voice is shot completely. Mm-hmm. But I lose my voice on the last day that I'm in San Francisco. And much to my surprise, my voice was gone by Friday night. So I made it through my session. And then my voice really went. And that caught me by surprise. So what that tells me is I was having to talk even more than I did last year, which means that there were a lot more people to chat with. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, that is a good thing. That is a good thing. All right, well, let's why don't we go ahead and kick into looking at the products that we thought stood out at the show, or at least some of our favorite products. We're not going to even really come close to all the standout products, but some of the ones that we liked, and then we'll talk about what we think about the show.
Okay, that sounds like a good way to roll.
All right, well let's start with one of the things I thought was really cool, called the VRM box from Focusrite. Does that work?
I think that sounds like a great place to start, because I'm really interested to hear what you have to say about that. And I'm not patronizing you. I really am interested.
Well, we won't even delve into what it might actually mean that you felt it necessary to say that you weren't patronizing me. We'll just gloss right over that. So the VRM box, what it does is reproduces reference monitors and rooms through headphones in a box. And that probably doesn't make a lot of sense, so I'm going to say it again. When you're recording a song, so first of all, this is aimed at desktop musicians and desktop producers and even producers on a professional level, as well as video producers that have to deal with sound. And what it does is when you're mixing a song, you're listening to it through speakers, and what musicians and producers do who are doing that sort of thing is they want to listen to a song through a set of flat speakers. And by flat speakers, we're talking about speakers that don't enhance the treble or don't enhance the bass or don't have any surround sound or, you know, whatever. They're flat. They're not adding anything whatsoever to the mix.
Okay, so would I be correct in assuming that means that if monitors like that are high quality, that the audio that's coming out of them should be as close to neutral and unchanged as you can possibly get.
Correct.
Okay.
Whereas most of the speakers that we use in for, you know, that we use as consumers, they're going to be, you know, like all of Bose's crappy products, they all have artificially tweak the way the sound is produced so that it sounds bigger. What right. A lot of headphones do is they have bass boost in them. A lot of a lot of speakers certainly are actually tweaked so that they enhance the bass one way or another, because that's what we want to listen to as consumers. But when a song is being mixed, you don't want to have that artificiality, because not every speaker is out there that's like that. So right. The reality, though, is that you need to listen to your music, or you need to even hear your soundtrack through a lot of different speakers so that it doesn't sound wrong in any of them. For instance, a traditional test is to make a tape, or, you know, in the modern era, make a CD, or even put it on your iPod, and then listen to your song in the car, preferably while you're driving, because that's where a lot of us listen to music, is in the car. And car stereo sound different than those great studio reference monitors that you've got in your studio, or maybe even the great reference monitors you have on your desktop.
Now, okay, so I've been told that listening to music in a car mm-hmm. is actually one of the worst music listening experiences you can have. If you compare it to say, having a nice setup in your home, or maybe you have a music listening room.
I would certainly imagine that to be the case, especially for most of us that don't have great stereo systems in our cars. But even when you do, you know, you've got road noise, and you've got dings, and you've got everything going on. But again, that's where a lot of music gets listened to. So, you know, you can't really finish a song before you've listened to it in at least one car. And, you know, so one of the things that a lot of pro producers will do is, in their studio, they'll have a set of speakers that replicates that, you know, crunchy, crunched up thin car sound.
Okay.
Kind of like the very, very noisy motorcycle that's going by me right now. And, you know, and they'll flip back and forth between sets of speakers to actually, you know, hear how it sounds through those different speakers. Now, so coming back to the VRM box, what it does is it allows you to flip from speaker to speaker to speaker sound without actually having those speakers. And it does so in a room, so you can actually position yourself, like how far away you are from the speakers, or how far you are to the left or to the right of the speakers.
Okay.
And I know that one of the settings, for instance, replicates a plasma TV. So, in other words, the speakers that the built-in speakers that a plasma TV might have. And you can just switch between these different environments through a click through the companion software. And it's really handy. It's really cool. I was only able to test it on the show floor, so I don't yet know how accurate they are, but my gut instinct is that they're very accurate, and I can't wait to actually play with it in a quieter environment. And you can get all that for $100.
Very nice.
Yeah, that's cool.
And that's a lot cheaper than going out and buying, say, 10 sets of specialized studio monitors, so you can jump between those.
Yeah, exactly. And, or, you know, putting a car in your studio, or like in your bedroom where your desk is.
Which, that'd be quite a party.
Yeah. Well, why don't you tell us about the Dolly Drive?
Oh, right. Okay. So the Dolly Drive, this is one of those products that I found that I thought was pretty interesting, but not for the reason that maybe the company wanted me to think it was interesting, which is okay. So the idea between Dolly Drive is, Time Machine is a nice tool for backing up your data, but wouldn't it be nice if you could have that backup everywhere you go? And so what they've done is created a service where for, I believe it's $10 a month, you get all this online storage that Time Machine recognizes as a regular Time Machine volume, even though it's through the internet. So that's actually kind of cool, because then you really can have a Time Machine backup that goes with you everywhere you go, as long as you have an internet connection. Now, the downside is you're trying to push all of that data that you're backing up through an internet connection. So that's going to take a long time on that first backup. But still, there you go. That's an option that's out there. And for a lot of people, that's going to be a very cool thing. What really got me excited about this was that they developed a companion application that lets you have a lot of control of your Time Machine settings. And you can use this application even if you don't use the service. And it gives you what I think is a much better experience for setting up your Time Machine preferences than Apple's own Time Machine preference pane. One of the big things it does is it includes the option to have include lists for your backed up content as opposed to exclude lists, which is all that the Time Machine preference pane really does. And and then it has an option for cloning your hard drive, so creating a bootable clone of your hard drive right in the preference pane. And they weren't ready to release the incremental automated clone feature at Macworld Expo, but that should be available in a couple weeks. So you can use this one application to manage your Time Machine settings with more flexibility than what Apple gives you. Plus, you can create bootable clones of your hard drive, and very soon you can schedule those clones and have them as incremental clones. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, so you can have a clone of your hard drive that's happening automatically in the background, and you don't have to worry about duplicating your hard drive before you go on a long trip. So the service is $10 a month, but the application you can download for free.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Interesting. All right. Well, let's bump up to performance design products, which is no indication whatsoever of what they're doing.
Yeah, but what they do is really cool.
It is. They're making, or at least this part of the company is making, so they make a lot of like gaming peripherals, like, you know, like PS2, PS3 accessories and Nintendo accessories and things like that. But the part of the company that we were looking at and that was showing at Macworld was cases for iPod and iPhone, well, iPod Touch, iPhone, and iPad.
And they're very cool cases.
They are. So first of all, they're all limited editions of 2,000 units only. And they've licensed imagery from, you know, Disney, Sesame Street, the Transformers.
Marvel Comics.
Marvel Comics. The NFL. They've got some football teams, too. And and they look really, really great. And, you know, really high quality. And because they're limited edition, they may end up having some collector value. We don't actually know because they're still fairly new.
Right. But they look really nice. And the case that I played with, which I think is probably the same model that you played with, I just have a different design. It was like a thin plastic piece that covered the back and wrapped up and covered the sides, but didn't come up over the glass on the front at all. So it didn't add any noticeable bulk, and it kept that whole front surface open. So if you're doing swipe gestures, the
case doesn't get in the way.
The case doesn't get in the way. Thank you. And as a nice little touch, that screen protector, excuse me, that ships with the case. If you look in the bottom right-hand corner of the screen protector, it has a little print of whatever is on the back. So, the one that I was playing with was the Kermit the Frog case. Mm-hmm. So on the front, there's a little print of Kermit the Frog sitting there smiling at you. But on the back, where the big Kermit face is, they positioned it so that the camera lens sits where his little eyeball would be.
Hmm.
So they've taken a lot of care in the details so that anytime they can set up an image on the case so that the camera opening can fit in with the overall scene, they do.
Right, right. That makes a lot of sense. And they've got I guess one of the things I liked about these things was just the attractiveness of them. You know, so there's Beaker, there's Animal. They were kind enough to give me an Animal one, which, you know, as a drummer.
That seems completely appropriate.
Yeah, it was hurrah.
Animal has hair that I think sometimes is a little similar to yours.
And I mean that in a good way. Keith Moon, my favorite drummer of all time.
Right. Right. The big difference being Animal is still alive and Keith died in a horrible way.
Indeed. And so there's Kermit, there's Animal, there's Beaker, there's Jack Skellington, there's several Jack Skellington ones, actually. There's also Mickey Mouse, there's Donald Duck. And what I like about some of them, so like the Animal one I got, this is not the case. But for the Mickey stuff, it's all distressed to look like it's super old.
Right.
And it's a really nice effect.
I noticed they did that with one or two of the Captain America cases. So it looked like they had been manufactured during World War II.
Right, exactly. And note, though, that I don't think that as of right now, there's none of the Marvel stuff is on their site in the link that we're going to include in the show notes. And we're going to have links to all of these products in the show notes.
Right. I think that the Marvel stuff that they had at the show, which would have been Captain America and Thor, I don't think that anything else, those releases will be coinciding with the film launches. So that
right.
So that'll be this summer.
They're definitely trying to leverage a lot of the film, the various film projects that are going on at the media companies.
Right.
So anyway, the really cool looking products are really cool looking cases. Just a really attractive designs. Really attractive design. Bright and colorful and well made. Plus the Toy Story Aliens. That's about the only Pixar. Product that I've seen for any kind of iPhone case.
Yeah, I think Disney's been very, very selective who they license properties like that to.
I wonder why.
Can't imagine.
Yeah, I was really surprised to see. You know, these are big dollar licensing projects, and so to have them in cases that are, you know, $30 for the iPhone cases, and I'm looking for the iPad case. iPad cases are $60. That's I was surprised that they could actually put together this kind of marketing deal and still charge those kind of prices.
Yeah, but they did it, and I don't think they're actually having any trouble selling out their runs.
No, I know that several of the products have already sold out.
Oh yes, and they did a whole thing for Tron Legacy when that launched.
Right.
And I believe that the day they announced it, and they announced it through a tweet, and that was it, as I recall. Mm. They immediately sold out of everything in one day.
Yeah, they've got on the site right now, they've got Tron iPhone 4 Circle and Lines.
Okay, so maybe there was a specific Tron case. I remember them telling me that they sold out of something Tron in one day.
That's funny.
Yes.
That's funny. Alrighty, why don't we jump down to, I think Hyperdrive was one of the products you liked.
Right. So HyperMac, they're the company that has the HyperJuice batteries, the portable batteries for your iPhone and iPod Touch. And they're also the company that was making the portable Mac laptop batteries that had a MagSafe adapter cable.
Right.
And they kind of got in trouble for that. And so they had to change how they're doing those. So, you know, just so people know which company I'm talking about. Well, they had a product that's going to be shipping in a couple weeks on display. And at first, I thought it was kind of weird and wasn't getting it. And then it clicked. And it's the HyperDrive for iPad. So it's a portable hard drive, USB hard drive, that connects to your iPad and can be used for additional storage for your iPad. And my first thought was, well, you can't plug a hard drive into an iPad and use it. But what they did was put in a little some type of bridging magic that tricks your iPad into thinking it's a camera memory card. So what you can...
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so you can load up a ton of photos and a ton of movies. It can hold up... They're going to have models that go up to a terabyte in storage. And so if you have a bunch of movies that you want to take with you somewhere and you don't want to fill up your iPad with just movies, load them all on the this hard drive. And then when you plug the drive into your iPad, the import application that pops up when you want to import photos also lets you import movies. So you can select the photos and movies you want to copy off of the hard drive, watch the content, and when you're done with it, delete it off of your iPad and then load more content off of the hard drive. So if you're, say, if you're going on a really long trip, maybe a tour around a country or through Europe, and you want to have all this content but keep your iPad open, you can use this to have all of that extra content available.
That's really cool. So I'm looking at the prices. They're definitely charging for this benefit.
Oh, yes. They are.
The case itself is $100. 320 gig version is $200. 500 gigs is $250. 640 is $300. 750 is $350. And you can get a terabyte, just, you know, like a terabyte of movies for your iPad on a long trip could be fantastic for $400. And that's obviously a lot more than standard hard drive prices.
Right. So in this case, what you're paying for is that magical bridging technology that makes the hard drive appear as if it's a flash memory card.
Right. Plus, of course, the fact that it connects to your iPad to begin with.
Right. So you'll need Apple's iPad camera connection kit. So you have the USB port adapter. Mm-hmm. But once you've got that, and the number of people that have that connection kit already is significant. So there's a lot of people out there that are already set up to be able to use something like this. And you can plug it into your Mac and use it as a hard drive there too.
Oh, that's great. So I don't have to only use it for the iPad.
Right.
That's pretty slick.
Yes, it is.
That's pretty slick. I like that. Well, let's look at another slick device. This one, actually, we're going to the iPhone or iPod Touch here. Although, I guess they have one that they're working on for the iPad, but they're not ready to announce that yet. this is the L5 remote from L5 Technology.
Oh, right. That's the little remote that plugs into the dock port, and then you can program it for specific devices, right?
Right. It's a little dongle. It's $50. And basically with a companion app that you can download for free from the App Store, you can actually download it whether or not you have the dongle. You can build custom universal remotes. And, you know, there are great universal remotes on the market. For instance, Harmony Mix, Logitech's Harmony line.
Right,
Is a universal remote that we've liked at the Mac Observer for a long time since they first basically announced themselves at Macworld and started making $1 jillion. there are other full screen, you know, LCD based universal remotes that are out there. But what I really like about the L5 remote is that you're effectively adding only those buttons that you want.
Oh, so you can create a completely customized remote control interface.
Yeah, completely customized. You know, and it's all drag and drop. You know, and you're building it right there on your iPhone, and it's all drag and drop. And you know, the different kinds of remote configurations have, you know, specific buttons in specific places, but you know, once you actually add them to the remote that you're building, you can actually remove and add buttons as you need to and train each one of them. Now, there's a downside to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that downside is that you have to train the remote software one button at a time. So you can't just, you know, enter once and then it's got everything on your DVD player's remote.
Okay, so they don't have like a starter template that has a bunch of functions and you can take off the ones you don't want and add in others.
Correct.
Okay.
Instead, what you're doing is you're adding basically, you know, you're adding the a template for, you know, like the power button, play, fast forward, and rewind, pause, and, you know, stuff like that. But then you actually have to train each one of them. And yeah, that's definitely a higher barrier to entry in terms of setup time. But the end result is that you've got this gorgeous display on your iPhone and you have only those buttons that you want. And the reality is that most of us only use 5, 6, 7, 8 buttons at the most on any of our remotes.
Sure.
Not counting the number pad.
Okay. Yeah, right.
You know, yeah, if you're punching in numbers for channels and stuff like that. But you can also do pre-programmed buttons for, like, you know, you can have a button for CNN. So, you know, you can have, I think it's, if I remember correctly, it was two rows of four buttons each. And I'm not sure if you can scroll past that, but you can have, you know, your button for CNN, your button for CNBC, your button for NBC, and your button for USA Today. And, you know, rather than having to click all the various things to get you to your TV and get you to your set-top box and then punch in the channel number, you just punch that button and it's going to do all that for you and take you to CNN.
Oh, nice. Okay, so it can have a little bit of programmability to go along with the buttons.
Right, except they're actually pretty easy to set up. I mean, it's not pretty easy. They're easy to set up. And I like, you know, the reality is that if, let's say you're planning on thinking about using this with your iPhone, you're probably not going to want to leave the dongle in there all the time. You can if you're going to actually charge your iPhone. So you do have to keep up with the dongle. So now the dongle is still sitting somewhere, and you have to not lose the dongle. And yeah, that's a real thing. Of course, you could always buy, say, a dedicated iPod Touch. Or maybe if you buy a new iPod Touch to replace your current one, maybe rather than, you know, just letting that sit in a drawer, you turn that into your universal remote. And
okay.
That actually makes a lot of sense. Right?
Sure.
So there's still something to keep track of, and there's something that can get lost. But at the same time, you know, if you actually are able to or not, if I'm going to say that differently. Once you actually get it set up, if keeping track of that dongle isn't a problem for you, it's super easy to use, and it's exactly what you want. And, you know, you can swipe up and down and swipe left or right to get different sets of remotes.
Okay.
And it's just, I think it's a cool way to approach the notion of universal remotes. That's what I think.
Well, I like the idea of having a completely customizable interface for my home entertainment remotes or remote, because you're right. There are a few buttons that I use on each remote, and that's it.
Right.
And I, you know, like my DVD player remote, that thing must have at least 50 buttons on it.
Right. And how many of them do you use?
You know, the power button, the arrows so I can select chapters.
Yep.
And play and pause.
Play and pause, maybe fast forward and
right.
And rewind and maybe a step button.
Sure. And oftentimes, I don't even need a step button.
Well, there's always that time when you really want to read that sign, or you really want to read what's on the piece of paper that the characters are looking at.
Right, and you have to step through frame by frame,
yeah,
to get just the right view. There is that.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's yeah, like you said. I mean, those are the buttons we need. And being able to set that up is just, I don't know. I'm looking forward to being able to try it out. I'm pretty excited about it. And they've definitely had a lot of success so far with the product.
Excellent. And so I'm assuming they have TiVo support too.
Yeah, anything.
All right, cool.
Yeah, they've actually got two databases. There's the database of products that they put together, and then there's the database of products that their users have contributed to.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so it's sort of a wiki for devices.
Okay, that's very cool, because I'm sure there's a lot of obscure pieces of equipment out there that people have, and they don't want to have to go and start from scratch.
Always.
That's very cool.
All right. What do you want to do next? Do you want to do the Yeti Pro?
No. Yes.
All right. Do you want to do... I took you at your word.
And I was just kind of screwing with you there. Because I think we're both a little exhausted from Macworld.
Yeah.
And so I was just totally screwing with you. Sorry about that.
Fair enough. Yeti right. Pro from Blue Microphones.
Right. So the Yeti came out, what, about a year ago?
Yeah, I think it was introduced last year at Macworld.
That's right, because they were showing off pre-production models at CES, and then we're planning on shipping by Macworld. So, yep, you're right. So, very nice mic. I think there's a lot of people that can use it as a professional mic if they wanted to.
Yeah, for sure.
And what made the original Yeti so cool was that you didn't need to have a breakout box. It was USB, so you could just plug it right in to your computer.
Right.
And use it. It had a built-in stand, and then it had a built-in headphone jack for monitoring your audio. And it had really good audio quality. You even used one for a while on the show.
I did. It turns out that I have a very specific issue. My desk is such that the surface of my desk is so large that it turns into a giant soundboard. And the Yeti stand, one of the cool things about the Yeti stand is it's got a really heavy base that makes it great for standing and not going anywhere. But right. It also makes it great for transporting sound all the way up to the microphone.
Right. And I remember that you were having all kinds of problems with bump and thump sounds.
Yeah. Anytime, you know, I moved my Ergo Rest, every little noise was transmitted up through it. You know, I tapped the desk or, you know, anything I did. So I had to stop using the Yeti. Just because of my particular environment, and I'm still using my Heil PR40, but I know that the guys at Blue, they're actually working on a shock mount that will stop that from being a problem for users like me who just happen to have a desk that isn't conducive to using a product like the Yeti. I can't use any kind of desktop mic, but it's interesting for me. The Yeti mic was so good it was a problem.
Yeah, there you go. So, all right. So, but the new model, which will have that same problem for some people until that shock mount comes out, it added in an XLR port.
Right. So, and 24-bit sound.
Right, and 24-bit sound. So now you have the option of plugging the microphone directly in to a USB port on your computer and using it that way, or going out to another mixer through the XLR port.
Right, which is why they're calling it the Pro, because the 24-bit is something that's going to appeal to more professional recording situations. And of course, the XLR cord, you know, most people don't need an XLR cord. They need the USB. That's the whole point of the Yeti to begin with.
Right. But adding in that XLR makes the microphone a lot more versatile for pros.
It does. It does. So that's definitely a really exciting product, and it's got a nice look to it. It's got this new black finish that they're doing.
I really like that black finish. I like it a lot more than the silver on the old one.
Yeah, I didn't have a problem with the silver, but now that I've seen the black, I think it looks better.
Yeah, well, yeah, same thing. Because the silver looked just fine until I saw the black.
Right, right. So I think they're going to have some success with that. I mean, they've already had some success with some. They've already had a lot of success with the Yeti. It was definitely a good product. The Yeti Pro, I think, is going to continue. You know, I like Blue Microphones. Those guys are good. They're one of the great companies that Dr. Bot has collected under their umbrella, and that's a cool thing.
I agree. And you're right. They do make a lot of great products. And the consumer stuff that they've come out with, I think, is wonderful. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Alrighty. How about we look at the Neo I?
Oh yeah. That's the projector, right?
It's the projector for iPhone and iPod Touch and an iPad through an optional adapter.
That's actually really cool. So a projector that's designed to be used specifically with the iPhone, iPad, iPod Touch through the dock connector.
Right. Right. So there are projectors. As a matter of fact, the Optima is the company. Optima has other projectors that they've had on the market for a while. They're called Pico projectors because they're small.
Right.
But in this case, it combines a 16-watt stereo system, stereo dock, stereo speakers, basically, with the projector. So while you're projecting your image up to 120 inches wide, but you got to be in a dark room for that to be for it to be visible that way, you also get pretty good sound.
And so, it'll keep your iPhone or iPod Touch charged.
Right, because it's a full dock.
Right.
And I think that, you know, most of us really don't need something like that. We don't need to project we don't need to watch a movie on our iPad projected somewhere. You know, if we're watching a movie on our iPad or iPhone or iPod Touch, we're probably in a mobile setting anyway, right?
Yeah, that's very likely. Yeah.
But I think that this has got a lot of really cool applications for, teachers, especially any kind of small environment teaching. Anyone who needs to be able to have a projector but doesn't otherwise have the resources to have that projector. You know, maybe you don't need a projector that often.
You know, when I was looking at this, I was seeing something that looked like a great option for education, business, and like user groups that need to do presentations.
Right, right. Yeah, user groups make a lot of sense. User groups make a lot of sense. And so now we covered, I forget the name of that company, but there was a company that was doing a laser Pico projector.
Right. I can't remember the name of the company, but I do remember the laser thing.
And that's because they never shipped.
Oh. Yeah, was that one of the companies that was showing at CES like a year ago?
And then they were showing at CES at Macworld 2 years ago. I mean,
Okay.
They had a really cool product. I think they were having some regulatory issues, and I don't know all the details, and so probably shouldn't actually speak too much to that.
No, let's make up details. Like the laser was burning holes through people.
No, it was not doing that.
No, but it sounds really good.
Yeah, and the nice thing about this Optoma project. So first, they're shipping.
All right, so they're a step ahead of the other guys. Benefit.
Yeah, and it's also an LED-based projector. So they can do a lot brighter without having to worry about what kind of licensing they have to have from the FCC. Because
right.
The laser projectors, you know, are limited in their strength
without burning holes through people.
Yeah, without actually being able to burn holes, right.
I'm just going to keep bringing that up as if it's real.
Well, I guess, yeah, that probably is an actual concern.
Right. I can't imagine a projector that size having enough power to be able to burn holes, but
yeah, probably not.
Yeah,
probably not. It's a good point. But this anyway. So Optima's product is an LED based projector, and you can do either 20 lumens or 50 lumens. And so when we were seeing it, they were showing it on small projector screens about not 120 inches. 120 inches is what, 5 feet? No, it's 10 feet.
10 feet.
Give or take a bit. I are too good at math.
We're so proud of you, Brian.
Thank you. This was probably actually about 4 feet wide. So, you know, definitely smaller, but it was also in a well-lit expo hall. So, you know, if you actually have a much darker environment, you can, and it looked good at that brightness in that well-lit hall. So,
okay, that's saying a lot. And that bulb isn't as bright as you can get in bigger projectors.
No.
But that's, from what I understand, a limitation of the projector size.
Yeah, sure. So it's pretty cool. It's retailing for $479, so it's definitely not cheap. It's not going to be for everybody, but if you happen to have a need for something like this, it's pretty darn cool, and you should check it out. It's at optomausa.com, and we'll have a link to that and all these other products in the show notes.
Right. Now, didn't you see some cool MIDI thing?
Yeah, that was the last one I wanted to talk about was the iConnect MIDI from iConnectivity.
That's it.
Relatively small company. And what this is, again, this is another niche product, but bear with us here. It allows you to connect a MIDI controller to your iPod Touch, iPhone, or iPad. And why would you want to do that? Because there's all these cool virtual instruments that are being made, especially for the iPad. And sometimes you need an external controller is going to be able to allow you to do a lot more with it, especially when it's a keyboard app.
Right. So just to make sure I've got this right, you could potentially use this if you're doing a keyboard app or using a keyboard app and plug in an external keyboard.
Yeah, that's precisely what you would do with it.
Okay. That's actually very cool because then your iPad becomes truly a portable recording studio and you can use the keyboards that you would otherwise have available to you.
Right.
And record straight into the iPad.
Or play live. Yeah, you can only record if the app supported
it. Right. But you can play live.
But you can play live. And they had a they were demonstrating it with drum pad controllers and little tiny keyboards because they just had a small little kiosk. And, you know, they were basically inviting people to come up and jam with them so that you get like three people banging away on keyboards and doing drum beats and stuff. And it was a lot of fun. So what's cool about this now I think that Line 6 has got a competing product and I haven't tested that yet, but as I understand it, it's a little bit high on the latency side. What iConnectivity is doing is they're actually targeting the high end. It's $179 for this MIDI interface, which isn't cheap, but it's because you're paying for almost zero latency. It's effectively zero latency in terms of you know what we can actually tell, which means that when you press a key, you actually get sound immediately.
Okay, that's a big thing. That's a very big thing.
You know, if it's press noise, press noise.
It's kind of hard to make music effectively that way.
It doesn't do you any good. And so they're using a pretty good processor to make this happen, which is why it's on the pricey side. And it definitely works. And, you know, music on the iPad is still in its infancy. And, you know, where it's going. I mean, the iPad itself shipped, 9 months ago?
Yeah, it's still not even a year old. And look at all the stuff people are doing with it now.
Look at all this stuff. Exactly. So that was the last product, and that's 8 cool products that we saw at Macworld, and I liked it.
Yeah, and we could go all night with cool products, but we love you, so we won't.
Yes, but we will talk about the show itself.
Yes, actually, I think that's a good idea.
Wait, hold on a second, Jeff. You know, before we get too carried away with talking about the rest of Macworld, let's talk about our sponsor, Smile Software.
Oh, yes, that sounds like a great idea, especially since Smile was at Macworld Expo.
They were at Macworld, and they were, yeah, good company. And I think we're going to talk about Text Expander this
Oh, I love Text Expander. All right, so if you're not familiar with Text Expander, it's this really great application. It's available for the Mac, iPhone, iPod Touch, and iPad that lets you take abbreviations and then automatically expand them into words and phrases, graphics, or scripts that run. So you can create your own abbreviations. And so when you type whatever it is, it automatically becomes what you wanted it to be. And it's something I use every day for signatures that I include in emails. There are certain pieces of code that I need to include in articles that I can just do a couple keystrokes and it automatically appears. And you can synchronize your abbreviations, I call them snippets, your snippet sets between your Mac and your iOS devices. So you can have all the same abbreviations on all your devices.
Right. And in addition to being able to use it on your Mac, where, of course, it's quite handy, the company has made an API available for other companies to use in their own iOS apps. So that as long as you have Text Expander installed on your iPhone or iPad or iPod Touch, you get the same functionality in those apps. And that's just super handy.
Oh, amazingly handy. Right. And the apps are priced, I think, very nicely too, especially considering just how amazingly useful and what wonderful time savers they are.
Exactly. And the folks at Smile, I mean, they're good to the Mac community. They sponsor a number of podcasts, including ours, and good for the Mac community. And they make great software. They get the Mac. They get that Apple way of doing things. And Text Expander is just one of those apps that once you've used it, you will wonder how you existed without it.
Oh, I agree completely. It's a lifesaver. It's something I use every day, quite literally every single day.
Right. Exactly.
Right. Exactly. So, what, $34.95 for the Mac version,
right,
and $4.99 for the iOS version.
Try to beat it with a stick. You can't do it.
No. And if you tried, actually, I'd be kind of sad.
Yep. So, there you have it. And with that, I guess let's talk about the show.
Cool. So, what was your overall impression of the show?
My overall impression of the show is that we've gotten past whether or not the show can exist without Apple.
I'll agree with you.
That's the first thing that was sort of tangible about the show. It had a different vibe. There wasn't a, you know, 2 years ago it was doom and gloom because we knew it was Apple's last show. Right. And, you know, Zoe can't exist without it. Last year it was, you know, hold your breath and you know, what's it going to be like?
Right. And there were a lot of people there. But a lot of those people were showing up because they really thought that would be the last year. So they wanted to be there for the end and go out with a big bang.
Right. And then other people weren't there because they were doing a wait and see.
Right.
You know, they were going to let everybody else test out the waters and see what was going on. And, you know, like last year I knew we had people from semi-large companies that were, you know, oh my God, people showed up for this, booked last minute flights and last minute hotel rooms
just so they could be there.
To have meetings with all the media that was there to cover the people that were supposed to be there.
Right.
You know, and which I thought was pretty ballsy. And
yeah, it's, you know, on one hand, I can understand waiting to the last minute for that year because that's a lot of money to invest, but then just showing up without going ahead and
booking rooms that day.
Yeah.
Booking rooms that day because it turned out that not everybody else was as much of a loser as they were.
Right. So, yeah. So there's a lot of companies that were scrambling to get into the game any way they could.
Right. So this year we had – now Ted wrote a great piece, I thought, today for us at the Mac Observer, Ted Landau.
Right.
where he, you know, he offered his summation of what he thought the show was. And one of the things that he pointed out was that the large companies are gone. You know, HP was about the only printer company there, and that really all they were showing was they didn't have the usual gargantuan booth that they usually have. They were mainly focusing on their AirPrint stuff, right?
Which totally makes sense.
It does to a certain extent.
Yeah.
You know, Apple wasn't there. Adobe wasn't there. Quark wasn't there. I don't think Nikon and Canon were there.
I don't remember seeing them. Belkin wasn't there.
Yeah, Belkin. I didn't see Belkin.
FileMaker wasn't there.
FileMaker wasn't there. That's a good point. I didn't even thought about that. So we had a lot of large companies that weren't there. But what we did have, I should say, is a whole bunch of small companies, many of whom we've never seen before, many of whom have never been to Macworld before.
Yes, there were a lot of new faces this year.
And a lot of booth babes. And as we all know, that is a very important barometer of the health of a trade show.
Actually, you're right. Yeah, that's what. Yes, there's a lot of people that are probably thinking, really, you think booth babes gauge a show? But the reality is that that's a very big part of a show.
It's a measure of the how willing companies are to invest additional resources into a trade show, and if they're willing to invest in hiring attractive talent that is there to get people into the booth, well, that means that they actually expect some outcome from the show itself. That's why it's not a sexist thing. It's a reality, and it is a barometer.
Yes, and there were definitely booth babes at the show, and they were roaming the aisles. So, excuse me. Yeah. So
they were being paid
to stand at booths and walk around the expo floor
and attract people. Yeah, that's the way it works. And now one of the things that I know that both Jeff and I did were we talked to people about, we talked to the vendors about the value to them in being at Macworld as opposed to, or instead of, or in addition to CES. Because there's a lot of competition now between the iLounge Pavilion and Macworld Expo.
Or yes.
Perceived competition, I should say.
And, you know, and to me, it's not a competition thing, although I know there are people out there that want it to be. But it's not a competition thing. It's a different show.
It is a different show, and they serve very different purposes.
Right.
And it's my, I guess it's probably an opinion we share, but it's my opinion that Macworld is very, very important to the ecosystem and to the community. So is CES, but in a different way.
Right.
And
Macworld is where companies go to interact with the media and end users. CES is where companies go to interact with the media and find channel partners.
Right. And the reality, and so, you know, you're looking for deals at CES, and at Macworld, you're looking for either direct sales or buzz or word of mouth or other kinds of exposure. But there's another kind of interaction that's important too, and that's simply vendors and companies being able to meet their customers and hear from their customers both about what they want and about what they think.
Right, and that's an important part of customer service.
It is. It is, and it's why, to me, it's criminal for Apple not to support Macworld. I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent here. But Apple talks about how they don't need Macworld because they have so many millions of people walking into their stores, and, you know, Steve Jobs announced that he's going to fart, and all the media in the world shows up to hear about it.
You know, that's why I'm glad that we can send you to those live events.
Anyway, all of that's true for Apple, but it's not true for, you know, anybody else on the planet for that matter. But it's not true for the rest of the Mac ecosystem. And the Mac ecosystem needs to meet with us as the press. we need to meet with the companies to see what they're doing and to you know, to get that face-to-face time in. And the companies need to meet with vendors with customers again to find out what they think and to show people what they think. And while not very many customers are making it to the show, obviously, right? Because let's say, you know, I don't know, I'm guessing I would imagine that we're going to find out between 20,000 and 30,000 people came to the show.
Okay, that based on how packed the place was, that seems reasonable.
Yeah, the place was packed all 3 days. That obviously is not a large proportion of even the Mac ecosystem, let alone the iOS ecosystem. But it is where word of mouth begins,
right? And those people that are going to Macworld Expo, in many cases, are also actively involved in their local Mac community, whether that's that they're seen as a resource to their friends, they're involved in user groups.
Right.
But they're going to go home and they're going to talk about what they saw. So, yeah.
And they're going to be participating in forums, and they're going to be commenting on articles and, you know, in the Mac press. And what the Mac press talks about is eventually makes its way to the mainstream. Right, I mean, there's a whole thing going on here that the Apple stores are not meeting, and can never meet, and will never meet.
No,
and that's why I think this show is so important, and why it's worth the support of not only Apple but you know, those big companies that weren't there. You know, and I also heard, I don't think you and I talked about this off camera, so to speak, Jeff, but as I understand it, Apple was taking meetings with vendors off-site.
I heard that.
So Apple was taking advantage of the fact that all these people were in town for Macworld, but they're doing so in a way that doesn't actually support the show. And it pisses me off.
You know, I got invitations from companies. Well, we both got lots of invitations from companies to meet with them for private demonstrations. Excuse me. Yeah, and many of those were from companies that were there but weren't at the show.
Right, and I've got mixed feelings on that. If it's a company that can't afford to show, you know, I understand. Like those guys that were outside making the that make the eyeballs. Did you see them?
Oh, yes. Okay, so you were nicer than I was. Because when I was outside, I was typically on my way to a destination, typically running late. And so I just kept going past them. But I remember seeing them outside.
I thought, you know, this a group of young men who were snowboarders who had the idea of making some kind of case or, you know, some kind of protection for their iPad, you know, for when it gets dropped. And so what they made is this case. It's not even a case. It's really protectors, where it's four balls that go in the corners of your iPad, and they're all connected together with a
like
cord,
a band, yeah,
like a band, so that they don't, you know, so that it all stays together. And they were demonstrating it by dropping their iPad onto the sidewalk to show that it wouldn't break, and it was pretty cool. And those guys can't afford to, you know, they're young, they've got this really tiny company, they're you know, they're doing grassroots marketing, they can't afford to show at Macworld. I'll talk to those guys.
Yeah, okay, I'll grant you that, and so thank you for stopping and talking to them, and now I'm feeling kind of bad that I just kept going past them on my way to whatever else I had to get to. But the other companies that had, excuse me, like really nice rooms set up in hotels and wanted you to come and see their private demos at the hotel, I didn't go to any of those demos.
I didn't either. And, you know, if I've only got so much time at Macworld, especially during a 3-day event, which is one day shorter than it's been in the past, and I had enough problems trying to meet with everybody that was actually you know, putting their money where their mouth was, and showing at the show itself.
Yeah, and taking the time to leave the expo and walk to a hotel.
Right.
I mean, just that time right there, that's the time of a vendor meeting in many cases.
That's true. And don't get us wrong, you know, these offsite meetings have been a part of every trade show for time immemorial. I mean, it's a reality. But I think that it's important to support those companies that are supporting Macworld because I think that Macworld is important to all of us.
I agree.
It's good for the ecosystem. And CES is good for the ecosystem in another way entirely. And the reality is that so we started this conversation off by talking about the fact that we asked vendors what they thought. And every vendor that I talked to said that the being able to interact directly with the consumer was very important to them, both from a product development standpoint and from a word of mouth standpoint.
I agree.
They all said it in different ways, but that was the general general vibe that I was getting.
That's what I was hearing too. And the companies that seemed to be kind of on the fence about coming to Macworld Expo next year were not on the fence because they didn't see the value in the show. It was financial because they needed to look at the numbers and figure out can they afford to do CES and Macworld, or if they need to scale back in both places so they can continue to do both shows, or if they have to choose one or the other.
And the union fees that are in place at the Moscone Center.
Oh, it's criminal.
Are just, yeah. I mean, you know, there's a world of difference between what happens in Vegas and what happens at the Moscone Center, which is has in place a number of agreements between various unions that basically add enormously and absurdly to the price of showing at a trade show. San Francisco is going to end up losing trade shows because of that, especially as the value of trade shows is being questioned more and more.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on the union fees. It is one of the biggest deterrents, I think, to going to Macworld because it adds so much to the cost. And you're paying these massive fees regardless of whether or not you're using the services.
Well, and regardless of whether or not you need the services.
Right.
That's the thing. And please keep in mind that I personally am not anti-union, but I am anti-
I'm anti-extortion. Yeah, there you go.
I'm anti-extortion. And, you know, I've talked to far too many vendors who have described just the most ridiculous scenarios that you could ever possibly imagine. Anyway, let's not get off on that anymore. I think that the cost associated with booth setup and booth teardown is definitely an inhibitor for some companies to show at Macworld.
I agree. So, but when you take the financial concern of having to deal with two major trade shows in 1 month out of the mix, companies were more than happy to say that they would be back next year.
Right. That's true.
And
I actually liked last year's February time frame. I thought that made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, that's right. Because it was it like the second week in February?
I thought it was like the 20th.
Or was it the end of it? It all just blends together.
Yeah, it made a lot of sense to me to not so directly compete with CES, but. Be that as it may, we've already gone on. We're at an hour and 4 minutes, my friend, and that's not counting the intro. So we should wrap up with my impression was this: the show floor was packed. There were several times when it took me many minutes to be able to get down a relatively short aisle because it was just packed full of people. People were having a good time. The vendors that I talked to were pleased. The consumers I talked to were pleased. The press that I talked to was pleased. The show floor was a little bit bigger. The number of vendors was bigger still, but the booths were smaller.
Right.
We didn't have anywhere near as many big, huge mega booths that like we've seen in the past and like you might see at CES or, you know, E3 or something like that.
Yeah, there really weren't any spectacle booths.
There were few spectacle booths.
Well, and by spectacle booths, I mean the giant, just crazy big booths.
Right. Yeah, I'll agree with that.
But there were definitely some big ones.
I know that, by the way, the vendors that I talked to that were selling things on the floor were doing, like, just pleased as punch with their sales results.
Right. Yeah, companies that I talked to were selling out of product, and they were not expecting to sell as much as they did, which is not to say they had low expectations for the show. They just simply didn't account for the actual volume of people that were going to be swarming their booths.
Right. All right, let's close with that. We didn't talk about this, but let's close by giving away a copy of Incredible iPad Apps for Dummies.
Oh, I think that's absolutely awesome.
Because we didn't do it last month.
Oh, well, let's do it this month. That seems like just a really great tie-in for the show anyhow, because that involves you, that involves Bob, that involves your sessions, and it's just cool.
So Incredible iPad Apps for Dummies is a book that I helped Bob Levitis write. It's my first book with my name on the cover. Yay!
Congratulations. That is long overdue.
Thank you. And basically, we just look at some of the great iPad apps in several different categories and talk about why we think that why and how they're used, basically. And if you will send us an email with a haiku about Macworld, I don't care. I don't care if it's any kind of haiku. I'm sorry, that's not true. It needs to obey the right rules. I don't care if it's pro Macworld, anti Macworld. You wish you could be there. Thanks for the coverage. Whatever. Anything you had to say about Macworld, send us a haiku about it, and we'll either pick the best one we like or draw randomly if we have too many, and you'll get a copy of Incredible iPad Apps for Dummies, and I'll sign it.
I think that's awesome. And I have to point out, it's interesting just how attached to haiku we are. because we could have said limerick, a sonnet, which that'd be kind of cruel to tell people to write a sonnet.
But what's great, though, is how many of our readers write really good haikus.
I know. I'm really impressed with the quality of haikus that we see.
I know, because we've been doing this now, I guess, for the last couple of years. We've tended to sort of fall into the haiku thing, and a lot of our readers have sent us some really good haikus.
You know, just to save people some Googling, hey Brian, what's a haiku?
A haiku, it's a Japanese form of poetry that uses a specific number of syllables in three lines. It's five syllables in the first line, seven syllables in the second line, and five syllables in the third line. And by and large, the third line tends to not entirely be a non sequitur, but tends to be a disconnected thought. Disconnected.
That's
off kilter.
I don't even know how to.
And I don't have an haiku in front of me. I'm not going to try to make one up on the spot. But anyway, if you need more information, go ahead and Google it.
I think that was a fantastic description of haiku.
Oh, thank you. So anyway, about Macworld, send you a book. Hurrah. And we should end this.
I'm laughing because when you said, oh, we should end this, I just found that incredibly funny, probably because I am still so tired from the show.
You are still so tired, so I'm going to stop you.
All right. So if you have anything to add or comment on, please send us your feedback at acm@macobserver.com. Oh, and remember, succinctness is next to steeliness. you know, if I had those words in front of me all the time, I'd probably remember them more. All right, and that's this week's Apple Context Machine. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sending us your comment and feedback. And feel free to follow me on Twitter. That's at twitter.com/jgamut.
And you can follow me at TMO. Actually, you can follow me at twitter.com/TMOBrian. That is Brian with a Y. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for us. And that's all for this week. And we'd like to thank Smile Software for their fantastic sponsorship. And that's all for this week.
Indeed, they absolutely rock. So, hey, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer. The Mac Observer, even.